You're welcome. Oh, yeah. You're welcome.
Thanks a lot, Chair. I think we have just a slight technical issue here. Thank you very much for the opportunity, Chair. Today, I will be doing the presentation on behalf of the drafting team. Chair, what we did with the response that was distributed to the members was to quote the sections or the clauses and then tabulated the main comments on it, so that there's an easy reference for the members. You don't have to go to the bill and back. So it seems a very long document, but in reality it's not. Chairperson, the first comment that I wanted to touch upon was that by the Western Cape government. The comment was made that the bill should be tagged as a Section 76 bill. You will know from the bill itself that the state advisors of the opinion that it's a Section 75 bill. So this is something that the department will not be able to deal with. Chair, the second aspect was the long title. Comment was made by Greenpeace that the measures referred to here in the long title, right there on the first line, to provide for measures to be put in place for the protection, safeguarding, etc., should be mentioned or should clearly state that those measures are to be in the public interest. As a drafting team, we are of the opinion that Clause 2E makes provision for the public interest issue in the in the bill itself. With regards to the preamble, there was another comment by Greenpeace that the preamble should refer to those fundamental rights that are affected. As the drafting team, we feel that the Constitution already guarantees the right, and it would be tautologous to repeat what the Constitution says in national legislation. And Chairperson, with regards to the issue of basic public service and the definition thereof, Right to Know felt that this definition is too broad. As the APCOF and some of the other commentators, what must be kept in mind is that Clause 16.2 really limits the declaration of the infrastructure to instances where the loss or damage, unlawful disruption or immobilization thereof may severely prejudice the provision of basic public services. So the inclusion of the phrase basic public services is not an effort to throw the net of critical infrastructure as wide as possible, but indeed just to denote the type of service that critical infrastructure could typically render. And those are one of the factors that are taken into account in Clause 16.2. With regards to the amendment of basic public service to essential service, I think Honourable Marker asked a question about that now, and I can respond that in feedback, this was one of the issues that we grappled with, because the moment that we refer to essential service in this Act, it immediately denotes a link to the Labour Relations Act, which was not the intention, and which is not the intention of this bill. So in order to avoid that type of confusion, we decided to stick to the words basic public service. This is also in alignment with the Criminal Matters Amendment Act 18 of 2015, which deals with so-called essential infrastructure damage, or as it's commonly known, cable theft. We all talk about the cable theft bill. So it's also aligned with that legislation. And then, of course, as the the Express then, the research unit, as well as APCOF, and I'm apologizing for jumping to and fro on the projector, both were of the opinion that critical infrastructure should be very clearly defined. NERSA felt that the definition of critical infrastructure complex should be deleted, and Right to Know stated that strategic installations are unaccounted for in the bill. To start with the first comment regarding the definition of critical infrastructure, the response is basically that the bill makes it clear that critical infrastructure is only those infrastructure that has been declared as such. So if there is no declaration, it is not critical infrastructure, and the provisions of the bill are not applicable. And I think this is an absolute key element in the Act that some of the commentators did not understand. The word critical infrastructure denoted sort of a situation to them where in fact it is the result of a very specific process. So the moment that infrastructure is declared critical infrastructure, the whole machinery of the Act comes into operation in effect. So this is the key that starts the engine in a manner of speaking. With regards to the deletion of the definition of critical infrastructure complex, I think NERSA, with all due respect, did not take into account that multiple critical infrastructures sometimes need to be managed together. And in the response, I mentioned Durban Harbour as an example, simply because there are a variety of critical infrastructures or national key points at the moment there. But somehow, these have to be managed in an orderly fashion so that each guy doesn't set up his own access control measures, etc., etc. So the critical infrastructure complex declaration is fairly important to create an orderly system in which these critical infrastructures will interact with each other. With the Right to Know campaign's comment that strategic installations are unaccounted for in the bill, this concept will disappear and be taken into the critical infrastructure process. The strategic installations was classification used by the police to denote government departments who were important but not declared national key points. So that was just a management tool within the SAPS itself, and those differences will disappear. Regarding the Cyber Response Committee, the research unit mentioned that mentioned NetGlack's disagreement in respect of virtually anything that refers to the Cyber Response Committee or the Cyber Crimes and Cyber Security Bill. And NetLAC raised this, or Business South Africa raised this issue time and time again. They were of the opinion that the bill cannot refer to legislation that is not enacted. And I think this was the core of the problem more than anything else. He submitted that there was a fundamental lack of understanding regarding the drafting issues involved, because certainly you may refer to other legislation that is about to be adopted, as long as the name of that bill does not specifically appear there. One can mention, for instance, cyber crimes and cyber security legislation as an example. We consulted the Department of Justice, who proposed that the Minister of State Security has, this is in connection just with the interaction between the two bills. We consulted with a state law advisor who was busy with the cyber crimes and cyber security bill. He proposed that the Minister of State Security has a first choice on whether infrastructure should be declared under the Critical Infrastructure Protection Bill or under the Cyber Crimes and Cyber Security Bill. In our mind, there is clarity that the bill before this committee only deals with physical infrastructure. There should be no ambiguity about that. The bill only deals with physical infrastructure. I will speak a bit later on about the mechanisms to combine the two bills and the interaction between the officials. Western Cape government felt that the definition of cyber crimes committee was too wide, but and they proposed the definition, but we are of the opinion that it's virtually the same thing and has the same meaning. Right to Know campaign commented that this bill and the cyber crimes and cyber security bill overlaps in many instances, but once again, we felt that as a drafting team, it was made very clear that this bill only deals with physical infrastructure. Definition of infrastructure, there were comments by the Western Cape government to request or to submit that the phrase information infrastructure must be taken out. And the committee's noted will be discussed with the state law advisor so that we can draft a proposal for the committee when the clause by clause the deliberations kick off. Then under National Commissioner, where it would fit in alphabetically, the research unit made a proposal that national security be defined. And the drafting team is of the opinion that such a definition could be considered. However, the proposal was, in our view, basically a dictionary meaning, and that doesn't convey anything beyond what we want to make clear in the bill itself, because national security national security is comprised of a couple of components which must also be taken into such a definition. It would include the aspects of the military, politics, for instance, our constitutional democracy, society, where law and order is an issue, economics, environment, other words, financial stability, energy, such as electricity, natural resources, such as water, mining. And these may have an influence on the manner in which a nation functions or exists. On the issue of organ of state, there was a mention of that by the South African Reserve Bank, and we just wanted to make it very clear that the Constitution defines organ of state as follows: any department of state or administration in the national, provincial or local sphere of government, or any other functionary or institution exercising a power or performing a function in terms of the constitution or a provincial constitution. A typical example there would be the South African Reserve Bank, which is regarded as an organ of state, or exercising a public power or performing a public function in terms of legislation. And this would, of course, refer to a body such as the Gautrain Management Agency, which is legislated for in that Gautrain Management Agency Act 5 of 2006. In respect of person in control of infrastructure, there were comments by the South African Reserve Bank that they needed to be included here, but it was felt that organ of state sufficiently provides for Reserve Bank, which would then, of course, fall under C, the head of a government department, or the head of any other organ of state, which would be the Reserve Bank. The Gautrain Management Agency stated that the situation is unclear in terms of the responsibility under Clause 2425, as Nicolette highlighted. And this is really a very good submission. It is noted, and a proposal will be drafted for submission to the committee during the clause-by-clause deliberations, because there are many examples of this public-private partnerships where the one may apply without necessarily the authority of the other, and the state, for instance, could certain responsibilities as a result of that. So this will be tightened up. This is the situation that I just referred to, where the concessionaire would apply, and as I said, the proposal will be drafted. government had an issue with the words in B2, where it states any other person. They said that it's vague and specific reference must be made. If I can take the committee to the definition. B2, where it says any other right acquires from any other person, and we agree that it is wide, and we note the comment and we will work on that definition. The Western Cape government proposed that we include a definition of republic. It is submitted that such a definition would not add to the interpretation of the bill, because the republic is the republic and legislation is interpreted according to the ordinary meaning of the words, and we submit that it's not necessary to define the republic. Risk category, Right to Know campaign commented that risk categories are not clearly defined in the bill, and we note this comment. It will be discussed with the state law advisor and we'll make the necessary proposal when it comes to the clause by clause deliberations. With regards to security and security measures, Right to Know had an issue with the definition of security. They said it's open-ended and may be abused, but from our perspective as the drafters, we felt that the provisions in the regulations would enable the minister to really limit the application of these security measures through regulations. So we would try and confine the space for security managers and security service providers to overstep their boundaries, and that the regulations should provide a very clear and distinct what they may and may not do with these security issues. The same with the security measures. We also propose that clause 27.1N adequately provides for standards that may be set by the minister. This comment was also made by the South Durban Community Environmental Alliance. With regards to the CIRA issue, the researcher correctly pointed out that the definitions refers to the Private Security Industry Regulation Act, which means that wherever in the rest of the bill it says security service provider, it means that it can only be a person who is registered and fall under CIRA. It would not be somebody who is not registered. In terms of clause 2, chairperson, we have the purpose of the Act. The research unit proposed that insertion of the word security measures applicable to be done in 2B, and if I may take the committee back to 2B, ensure that information pertaining to critical infrastructure remains confidential. And I think it's a very valuable comment, so that it be amended to read, ensure that information pertaining to the security measures at critical infrastructure remains confidential, etc. So this proposal will be drafted for submission to the committee. Clause 3, the application of the Act, the research unit and the SA Catholic Bishops Conference commented on the exclusion of the Department of Defence Infrastructure. The exclusion of the Department of Defence Infrastructure was on their own request. They specifically requested to be excluded, and the motivation was that sections 104.4 and 19 of the Defence Act provide for offences relating to entering and access of defence installations, and that they would be able to secure their own installations without having to resort to private security companies and also to access control measures, which they can Greenpeace also commented on this issue. They said the bill should state that it does not limit certain constitutional rights except to the extent necessary to prevent significant harm or damage. As stated previously, the Constitution already guarantees these rights, and we feel that it would be unnecessary wording in the bill to repeat what the Constitution says. With regards to Clause 4, the establishment and composition of the Critical Infrastructure Council, the remark was made that government officials should be vetted. We agree with that, and it will be built into the clause and presented to the committee as a submission presented. Then on the members appointed in terms of subsection 6 from the private sector, the research unit as well as the Western Cape government commented that the appointment processes must be strengthened in ensuring partiality. We felt that this is something that the committee will give the drafters guidance on. If it is necessary to do this through a parliamentary process, then we will consult with the stakeholder advisor and prepare the submission in that regard. If it is in principle decided that these members be appointed by Parliament, etc., those processes can be brought into the bill. The South African Reserve Bank and APCOF alluded to the fact that the private sector members should have more versatile qualifications. I think also the Reserve Bank, and not only limited to the qualifications stated in the Act. After considering the submission, I think that that is a valuable contribution, and we will certainly look at that. There are functions of the National Commissioner which we'll talk about a bit later on, and I will alert the committee to that in the meeting. Chair, then, NEDLAC regarded the vetting process as intrusive, as the research unit already intimated, and I think it's clear that it would be advisable not to forego the vetting process. One of the arguments at NEDLAC was that this vetting can be done by one of the private vetting companies which exist. We feel that is not an option, or at the time we felt it's not an option, because this is somebody that you pay to vet you, and it would definitely not satisfy the requirements of this type of security clearance that must be obtained. And therefore, we were not amenable to that. The research unit also mentioned that the bill must set out the clearance level. That comment is noted. We will take it up. I think this can also be discussed in the committee, Chair. I'm not sure whether the bill would be the correct place to state that it must be secret or top secret, but it's something that we noted and we'll be able to discuss when we get to that clause. Subclause 7, Secretary for the Police Service is the chairperson of the council. The Western Cape government proposed that the chairperson should be appointed on recommendation of Parliament. In this regard, we feel that the position of chairperson on this council is typically the type of oversight role that one wants the secretariat to fulfill, and that it falls within the function of the secretariat. The issue of appointing members for 4 years and that the period should be extended to 5 years, that's agreed. We do not have any problem with that. In the first submission before the committee, it was said that these periods of service are not renewable, but they are in fact renewable for one further term. It was stated that clause 411B should be strengthened to clarify the process of selection. selection of the candidates for appointment. However, we felt that the process is fairly clear. The minister may decide to choose a shortlisted candidate or one from the pool of the candidates when they go through the whole advertisement process and selection process as stated in Clause 6. So we felt that the word despite paragraph A denotes the position that the minister may comply with the one or choose to follow the other process. Then with regards to disqualification, NASA proposed that the committee add a person has been removed from a position or an office of trust. This comment is noted and we will discuss it with the state law advisor for possible inclusion in a submission that we will do to the committee during the clause-by-clause deliberations. Chair, then, funding and remuneration, this is something that I think is very important for the purpose of the bill to get a picture of. The expenses that would be incurred will only involve the payment, of course, of the private sector members. We did a preliminary costing in 2016, and it worked out around R900,000 for the per year to remunerate the council, fly them up and down, put them up in a hotel and give them food. So one would expect, or we expected the amount to be much higher, but it seems that this is a fairly reasonable amount. NASA proposed that the council should be allocated its own budget to enhance independence, but we note the proposal, but the drafting team felt that this will have a knock-on effect. The moment that you allocate the budget to the council, they will have to appoint staff to manage the council, and there will be a whole permanent staff contingent in the end, and the budget will just balloon out of control. So we felt that it was best to use existing structures to deal with that. Clause 7, functions of the Critical Infrastructure Council, there were quite a lot of comments on this. The research unit mentioned that organized business proposed that the role of stakeholders in the cybercrime and cybersecurity bill be clarified, but we felt that the clarification cannot be in this act, it must be in that bill. And that is one of the issues that we will discuss with that state law advisor when we engage with him. Also, public-private cooperation needs to be promoted. There is a proposal to insert 7A8 to read any relevant matter or mechanism to promote public-private sector cooperation. This will, of course, be submitted to the committee during the clause by clause. There's also a comment that the Critical Infrastructure Council should approve the policies and guidelines developed by the National Commissioner. We felt as political head of the departments, one would expect those policies to be approved by the Minister. The role of the Critical Infrastructure Council should be to provide a mechanism, or should serve as a mechanism to assist the Minister in applying his or her mind properly. So the critical infrastructure's role is really to support the minister in making those decisions. NASA made a proposal to delete a certain word in clause 7B. I could not figure out what that was, chairperson, so it's unclear what the proposal contains. And then there was also a proposal to insert the words at least in clause 7G. Now, if you look at clause 7G, it says compile and submit a report to the minister within 3 months after the end of each financial year. They wanted to insert compile and submit a report to the minister at least within 3 months after the end of each financial year. And our submission is that it would not change the current meaning and may even make it more vague. financial sector and the infrastructure council, NERSA, also to mention that clause 8 must provide for a quorum, but we submit that clause 27.1b provides for regulations on the issue, where the minister will make the necessary regulations to set out the function and functions and functioning of this committee, meeting procedures, etc., will be in those regulations. With regards to the functions of the National Commissioner Chair in Clause 9, I will skip to the comments. The research unit pointed out that Clause 4A to C creates a new process with Clause 24, I think. And this is the reference where an application is received and it appears that it concerns critical information infrastructure under the cyber security bill, that it must be referred to the cyber response committee. And the research unit is 16-4 rather, sorry. And the research unit is absolutely correct with that contention. There is an overlapping or a dual process which is not advisable. We will discuss this with the state law advisor responsible for the cybercrime cybersecurity bill with a view to submit a redrafted process in terms of that section, but also section 16.4 or clause 16.4, where the matter must be referred to the Minister of State Security. The issue, of course, with the information infrastructure is that the critical infrastructure processes work on the basis that the application is submitted to the National Commissioner. The National Commissioner reviews, puts all the reports in place, sends it up to the Critical Infrastructure Council, who recommends it to the Minister, whereas it seems that the cybercrime and cybersecurity issues are directly handled by the Minister. So it creates a bit of a protocol issue where functions functional officials refer matters directly to the Minister for State Security, but we will discuss that issue with the State Law Advisor and make the proper submissions to the committee to rectify that issue. NASA wanted to insert the words "and recommend" to the Council in 9.3a, but it is submitted that 9.3c already covers this aspect. They wanted to delete the word "such" before "critical" in 9.3c, but the proposal was noted, but if you look at the proposal, Chair, it's clear that the bill links the preceding paragraphs through the use of the word "such," so we would not support such a contention. And then NASA also proposed insertion of 93H2 in that paragraph to insert the phrase "for declaration as infrastructure" after the word "application." It's unsure why they made the submission, because it is already contained in the text. Western Cape government wanted to clarify the recommendation in 9.2 to insert the words "and approval" to ensure that CIC approves the standards, etc., that are made, because the National Commission will develop certain standards and protocols submitted to the CIC, who in terms of the current bill will refer it to the Minister. Western Cape government felt that the CIC could very well approve those developed standards, etc., as it is not necessarily a policy decision, and we note this proposal, so when we get to that clause, we will submit a proposal to the committee. The National Commissioner may in the prescribed manner apply for the declaration of infrastructure as critical infrastructure. The research unit commented on the establishment and maintenance of an administrative system that is one of the functions of the National Commissioner. But from the perspective of the SAPS, it's quite clear that the current National Key Point absence of inspectors, there was a lot of comments about that. The research unit and the South African Catholic Bishops Conference maintained that the inspectors should obtain consent. I think that discussion was already made earlier. In principle, there's no problem with that. But, of course, it creates a difficult situation where the inspectors are not allowed access. And what must be remembered is that these are routine inspections. These are not searches. These are not invasive searches and entry into a private property. This is a workplace, and as much as a food or health inspector would be able to go in there, or, for instance, in the case of Kuberg, one of the nuclear regulators inspectors, the same would be the case with critical infrastructure inspector. The regulations, once again, provides us with the opportunity to, as the minister, of course, to create a very tightly controlled instruction set for the inspectors on what they may do, what they may not do. And this is obviously one of the issues that when we draft the regulations, we will certainly look at that to make sure that there's no room for abuse of powers. Then an inspector may issue a compliance notice without a magistrate. There were comments that this would give the inspectors too much powers. As I just said, we will prescribe those powers as far as possible. In terms of clause 27.1G, where those standards will be promulgated. NERSA commented and proposed an insertion into clause 11.3B, but that they must have worked in the old version, chair, because the comment is not understandable. Same with clause 11 sub 7 sub A, which is now clause 8. I think they may have been working on a previous draft version of the bill. The South African Catholic Bishops Conference made a very good observation that there is a reference error in the bill, which will be corrected, of course. Chair, on the issue of ad hoc and standing committees, the comment was that clarity on 12.4 in respect of the committee members and private sector advisors should be obtained. The intention is certainly not to create the possibility for the use of private sector advisors through this clause. The committees that we talk here, as they function presently, normally comprise of representatives of the national key point or other government structures, whether it be disaster management, local traffic management, fire services, etc. So it's not envisaged that private sector experts, and forgive my spelling mistake, they will need to be employed, and the remuneration of these people will not be an issue. We also do not foresee that committees will necessarily consist of one person. You know, obviously you try to avoid that situation. A valid point was made that members of these committees must have valid security clearance certificates. The regulations will determine that, but Chair, in my experience with national key points, the people who work on these committees normally have the clearance as they already sit on the joint planning committee of the national key point, etc. The remark was made why the vetting cannot be done by SAPS, because of the fact that SSA is a bit overburdened. Section 2A of the National Strategic Intelligence Act assigns this function specifically to the SSA under the current dispensation, and the police will therefore not be lawfully entitled to do this. With regards to the Cyber Response Committee as a standing committee, the committee is created in terms of other legislation, is therefore not answerable to the National Commission as such, but as a separate entity. The intent is to create a link between the Council and the Cybersecurity Bill to consult of on matters of mutual interest. The Cyber Response Committee does not advise the National Commissioner as the SAPS is represented on that committee. What is important about the Cyber Response Committee, Chair, is that it also deals with intelligence from other countries, and there's a mutual cooperation, that type of thing, that is happening in terms of terrorism and related threats. In other words, this committee is quite a repository of information, and we feel that its status as a standing committee should be retained. The Reserve Bank proposes the insertion of clause 12.9 to ensure consultation with the Reserve Bank in cases where financial stability is an issue. We noted that comment, and a proposal will be drafted for submission. There is a possibility that we are formulating to have the consultations with this financial stability regulator, or the financial stability committee even, take place when the application is received by the National Commissioner, so that you don't obstruct the process when it's near its end, but rather get all the sign-offs and all the agreements and consultations right in the beginning of the process. So it's possible that drafting team will try to slot that in there. Chairperson, the research unit in the initial document stated that the minister may delegate regulation making to the National Commissioner. This is correct. It is excluded in terms of clause 14.1. I think it was just a typing error, I'm sure, because the rest of the document is incredibly comprehensive. So it's not to be seen as criticism, please. Chair, clause 15 that deals with reporting by the minister, there were comments by Right to Know to say that the reporting must be transparent. Yes, that has been done in this version of the bill. Previously it referred to the Joint Standing Committee on Intelligence, but it was amended to read Parliament because we felt that the whole secrecy issue should not play a role with critical infrastructure protection, as these matters will be discussed in this committee. In all probability, referred to this committee. Then with regards to the power of the ministers, Chair, this is also one of the areas where most of the comments were focused on. Research unit, APCOF, Right to Know, there was an APCOF concern about the basic public service institutions that could be deemed critical. This could include clinics, schools, universities, as well as, and it's also a Right to Know campaign issue. But once again, it must be reiterated that critical infrastructure only gets the status of critical infrastructure when the minister declares it after that rigorous process of checking that against the requirements of Section 16.2b. It's clear that infrastructure as a broad concept may include clinics, schools, universities. But when the regard is had to 16.2b, where the requirements are set out, it's clear that the declaration of critical infrastructure is limited only to infrastructure where the loss, damage, unlawful disruption or immobilization by severely prejudice the functioning or stability of the economy, the public interest with regard to safety and the maintenance of law and order, the provision of basic public services or national security. So there is an internal limiter in the severely prejudice phrase, but also I do not see how a school or a university would conceivably fall or pass this hurdle. The same with the South African Banking Association. It's very difficult to see how a bank can apply to be declared and pass this initial hurdle, because this is a fairly difficult hurdle in the sense that there must be really some importance attached to that infrastructure. Then with clause 17, the minister must have regard to the factors. So 16.2 is the first hurdle for an applicant to pass, but 17 sets out all the factors where, for instance, the sector, that's water, energy, communication, strategic importance, terms of the country's ability to function, deliver basic public services, or maintain law and order, for instance, government structures such as parliament or the police. And I'm not deliberately grouping police and parliament in one grouping chair right now. See, it was just a coincidence. But also important is the risk category, whether the applicant can afford to maintain the security measures, because the critical infrastructure will be cleared on the application of the infrastructure owner itself. And this is, if I may pause here briefly, a lot was said about the reason why a person must state whether they have the financial resources to put in place these security measures. Remember, the critical infrastructure is declared on application by somebody, and that somebody is the owner or the person in control. And that person in control will have to state, look, I have 6 cameras and 2 gates. And after the security assessment, one has to be realistic in the sense that you cannot expect that person to put in place everything immediately, and there's a negotiation process that will take place, etc. But the resources of the applicant is quite important, because that will tell us whether there's an issue with the security measures themselves. An institution like, for instance, the Reserve Bank, if they would apply today to be declared, their security measures would exceed the requirements of the current system by far, which is the case with most private institutions. But anyway, those are the factors that must be taken into account, chairperson, and I think it's important to keep in mind that the wording basic public services doesn't throw open the gates. It actually narrows it down, because the question will be, will this severely affect the public's function to deliver basic public services? Not a basic public service, but basic public services. There was a comment that section 16 and 20 must be brought in line with each other. We felt that it was not necessary. Section 16.1 states, subject to the provisions of this chapter, and then obviously clause 20 falls within that chapter as well. So clause 20 already defines clause 16, and the sections are linked. In terms of the chronology and the reason why it's set up in that bill as it is, chairperson, I mentioned there that the chapter first establishes the powers of the minister to say, yes, the minister has the powers. Then it sets out the factors that must be taken into account. Then there are two processes created for application, and then it deals with the declaration itself. So we try to follow a flowchart, if you want, of this starts with, does the minister have the power? Yes. What must he take into account? These are the application procedures he may declare it. If, however, of course, the committee is of the opinion that this section 16 and 20 issue is confusing, we could easily consider that for a redraft proposal. There was also a comment that the role of the council is not expressly provided for here in the declaration process. We do not agree with that, because the comment that I made, or the response that I just gave, really brings the council also into the equation. The Western Cape provincial government felt that it is better, this Critical Infrastructure Council is better placed to decide on the declaration instead of the minister. But it's admitted that the minister is the political head, and he should ultimately carry, he or she should ultimately carry the responsibility as the council is in an advisory capacity. This committee can of course decide otherwise. It's not, I think, illegal for consultations with the provincial MEC, where the CI falls within a provincial government's property portfolio. It submitted that if it falls within a provincial government's property portfolio, the provincial government will be the applicant. So they will give the input in the application automatically, and it's not necessary to provide specifically for that type of consultation. In any event, before any decision or proposal is, or recommendation is made, they get a second bite at the apple to give comments on the decision. Greenpeace felt that Parliament should play a role in the declaration of critical infrastructure. And we felt from the beginning that it's important that Parliament has a role, which necessitated the clauses on reporting to Parliament. Because the moment this report receives Parliament, your oversight function is activated and you know, the natural processes will follow from that. But of course that's also an issue that this committee will give us guidance on. Greenpeace, Social Justice Coalition, Right to Know are all concerned about the proliferation of critical infrastructure, which I think is possibly a legitimate concern, because the bill seeks to protect on a wider front, whereas the National Key Points Act dealt with basically the security or the defense of the Republic. This deals with attacks on the Republic on a broader front in various sectors, water, energy, transport, etc. So that is a legitimate concern. But we felt that the risk categories should actually limit the proliferation of those high-risk institutions that are declared with a stringent security measures, where access control will be severe, whereas the lower-risk critical infrastructures would not have to put in place so many extreme security measures. So there is conceivably a possibility that there may be a proliferation, but we submit that the proliferation of the critical infrastructures with those extreme security measures would not take place. It would in fact become less, because some of the current national key points would also be downgraded to a lower risk category, if I may use the phrase. The Social Justice Coalition had a comment about the national security, what does it constitute, proposed a definition, or wanted a definition, and we already responded to that in the definition section. Right to Know, South Durban Community Environmental Alliance. Clause 16.2 is overly broad and vague, and clause 17 is open-ended. I think the first comment that was made on this issue, Chairperson, is also applicable here, where we say this is indeed not the case. In fact, it narrows the application and it makes it more difficult for declaration. The South African Catholic Bishops' Conference felt that provisions should be made for the possible negative consequences of a declaration. Clause 17J refers to the positive effect that it may have, but it doesn't take into account the negative effect that it may have on the community, and it submitted that this is not an unreasonable comment, and we will draft a proposal for submission to the committee on that. Chairperson, the Cybercrime and Cybersecurity Bill issue dealt with. Western Cape government made a comment in clause 16.4 that it should be amended to delete the words "and communications" because it refers to information and communications infrastructure. Those words came from a previous version of that bill, so we will amend it, and the proposal will be submitted during the clause by clause deliberations. With regard Clause 27.1J provides for regulations in terms of which standards and guidelines may be regulated for. We submit that the whole issue of risk categorization is very dynamic, and it may change from one decade to the following year. This would have been the case on the day before an incident like, for instance, 9/11. After 9/11, the dynamics changed. So we would propose that the risk categories be defined and described and set out in the regulations rather than the Act itself, just to allow us the possibility of amending them when necessary and when the circumstances require. Chair, there was a reference to the special account in the National Key Points Act, and that something like that could be used here to defray some of the costs. That account was never utilized. It was severely criticized also in the Right to Know campaign judgment. The reason for this provision is that the declaration will always follow on an application. So if an applicant has the required resources, the security measures can be put in place. If not, the applicant has the opportunity to sort of enter into an agreement about the way in which the required security measures will be placed, put in place over a period of time. Chair, the Western Cape government, once again, in terms of the pattern of their comments, they wanted to assign the function of determining factors of Clause 17K to the Critical Infrastructure Council, not the Minister. I think I already responded to that. With regards to the application process, Right to Know commented that there's lack of public participation in the declaration process, as did South Durban Community Environmental Alliance. I think they may have just skipped over Clause 18.3a because there must be a public participation process, and those reports must also accompany the application when it is forwarded to the Critical Infrastructure Council. Then, in terms of Clause 19.3b, the research unit remarked that it should provide for a time period. It's a good suggestion, and the proposal will be drafted. It was also remarked that written representations in terms of Clause 19.3 should accompany the application to the Critical Infrastructure Council. There is no specific provision for that, and the comment is noted. We will draft that proposal. Banking Association of South Africa submitted that banks can be declared critical infrastructure if the National Commission applies. If such a declaration is done, it must be in consultation with the Financial Stability Oversight Committee. But it submitted that banks do not, well, at least on the face of it, comply with the requirements in Clause 16.2a. So however, the comment is noted. In terms of the consultation process, as I referred to earlier with the Reserve Bank, those consultation processes will be built in as early as possible in the application process, so that you have a comprehensive application that flows from the comprehensive information that goes with the application. Western Cape government also commented that Clause 19.3b, where there are time frames, those time frames should actually be limited to expedite the process, but we feel that it's very important that there is a public participation process and consultation processes with the applicant, so to limit that would possibly fall foul of the Promotion of Administrative Justice Act. Chair, Clause 20, we are nearing the end. Apologize if this is very...
No, the members is the whole day available to work.
Okay, no, thank you, Chair, because we try to be as comprehensive as possible, just to assert the members' note the difficulties that you sometimes have. Clause 20, the declaration itself. Western Cape government commented that clause 22, in other words, the custodian should also be afforded an opportunity to make written representations. And this comment really supports the Gautrain Management Agency contention. And as I said, this is noted, and we will draft the submission for the committee when we get to that point. Our initial sort of feeling is that the applicant should make sure that he gets sign off on all, from all the custodians or the owners of the property, etc., when they apply, because that would prevent a situation where the application lands on the National Commissioner's desk and the National Commissioner does not necessarily have the knowledge to say, but the Gautrain Management Agency must be involved in this. So we will build that into the application process. Once again, they continued with their contention that the Infrastructure Council should be the functionary. The South African Catholic Bishops Conference stated that the period for representation should be longer in clause 22b. Once again, it must be kept in mind that the application is made by the person in control. So the person in control will have knowledge of what is in the application, but we are not opposed to it, and the period could be extended to 60 days. The Western Cape government took issue with clause 21.4, where it says wording is ambiguous, sorry, it is a bit ambiguous also, but it's ambiguous and needs to be clarified. The clause in question reads as follows: the declaration of any infrastructure as critical infrastructure does not exempt the person in control of a critical infrastructure from having to comply with the provisions of any other law except as may be provided for in this Act. We feel it's not that ambiguous, but the comment is noted. The proposal will be drafted for submission. We wanted to prevent with this clause, honourable members, the situation where a person says, but undeclared critical infrastructure, property valuers or the municipality may not come and need the electricity or whatever the case may be, and they try to dodge their other responsibilities in terms of other legislation. Then with regards to clause 21, subclause 6, the minister must publish the particulars of the infrastructure. Right to know commented that transparency requires that the CI sites be known, but we submit that clause 21, 5 and 6 adequately provides for the standards that must be met with these issues. Then on clause 24, which is of course the powers and duties of the person in control, this is a very contentious section and deals with the inter alia with the private security service issue. The research unit felt that the provision seems only to apply to government and state organs, but any type of service rendered by a privately owned critical infrastructure will in some form or another be in support of service delivery by government. Most of these privately owned companies do what they do either to assist the government department or to sell whatever they make to a government department. So this clause ensures that a privately owned institution, such as, for instance, an oil refinery, who deals with the Department of Mineral Resources, or explosive manufacturer who deals with SAPS as the administrator of the Explosives Act, may be required to assist. Western government to issue with clause 24.1. If a person cannot afford the security measures, what are the next steps? I think I explained that the applicant would normally already have certain measures in place, and you know, they would certainly have to state that in the application, and the security evaluation will determine what exactly is needed. What is ironic, Chair, is that most private companies who apply for national key point status have better security measures in place than are actually required by us. Another interesting and not useless fact. Another interesting fact is the rebate that the Income Tax Act allows private companies who are declared national key points. This act is no exception, and they can get the rebates on the income tax for expenditure on security measures. Last year, only one private company applied for that rebate out of all the privately owned national key points. So even though they are incentivized, it seems that they're not interested. The South African Catholic Bishops Conference commented that all costs for security measures should be financed by the state. I think this is a matter of policy. If we were a rich country, it would be wonderful to be able to do that, but we have limited resources. And in 99% of cases that I'm aware of, the private entities who are declared national key points have some form of relationship with the state. So there is Section 20 sub 4 that allows for assistance after application to the minister. Then the issue around the demarcation and the notices. Chair, the research unit, we're still on the expenditure for security measures. We are of the opinion clause 24.1 is unambiguous. The financial resources of the applicant is one of the factors that the minister might consider, but it's not the only factor. And once again, the person who applies will normally be the person who has already included the bill for some form of security measures. Clause 24.4 is not clear on whether it applies to privately owned infrastructure. Clause 24.4, if I may just take the committee back to that, is quite clear on the fact that the person in control must show good cause why the state must assist with payment for the security measures, but it applies to privately owned infrastructure and state-owned companies as well, because it would obviously be illogical for a government department to apply for assistance from itself. So it's certainly not applicable to government. Further comment, the bill should state that the security service provided for in clause 24.3 is private security and should be subject to zero. We already dealt with that issue. Could a security manager be appointed from a private security service provider, clause 24.7? In that regard, the intention has always been that the person must be a full-time employee, because we want the person in control of the critical infrastructure to take responsibility, appoint an employee who is not a contractor and can disappear at any time. So we note the comment and we will look at strengthening that subclause. Another question was asked, how are the costs that are to be recovered in 24.6 going to be determined? If the minister has to step in, put security measures in place, and then recover that cost from the person in control of the critical infrastructure, who's going to determine that? We are of the opinion that this would be a normal civil claim process where the minister would institute a civil Cape government stated that the minister must be empowered to close critical infrastructure and not only secure it, which we think is a bit drastic. It's a wide-ranging proposal. It will definitely be seen as draconian if a minister can close a critical infrastructure, such as Coburg or E-Natus. So, with all due respect, we do not support that contention, as it may defeat the very object of the bill. Chair, access to critical infrastructure, clause 25. That's also a contentious subject, and we got many, many comments on that, and I think many of them quite valuable. Research unit and COSATU specifically said that clause 25.6 requires that searches be done with regards to decency and order. Research unit proposed a reference to section 29 of the Criminal Procedure Act, and I think we note that comment and we'll take it further and draft a submission for the committee, because it's an important aspect that has to be complied with. This is besides the guidelines or the standards that the security guards will have to comply with in terms of the regulations issued under clause 27.1N. Penalties should be imposed for the person in control who fails to comply with clause 24.8 and 25.8. It's an interesting suggestion. Clause 24.8 states that a person in control must at the perimeter of the critical infrastructure put or demarcate that it's a critical infrastructure, and 25.8 of course states that the person in control must have a notice at the entrance to say this is critical infrastructure and you are entering on the following conditions, etc. And the proposal is that that be made an offence if the person in control fails or refuses to do that. We take note of the comment to a person, and we will take that on board in a submission to the committee. Western Cape government, persons should be notified before they enter critical infrastructure about the searches. It's an interesting comment, but I think it should be noted, because it often happens that you enter some place and then at some point you see now you're going to be searched. So it would be better to have that notification and warning right up front where a person before they enter will know exactly what's going to happen. So we take note of that, and it will be included in the submission. Clause 25.2b, the comment was made that it must include personnel of service providers. I think this is just a technical comment, because the clause refers to the security manager or the security service provider, but this comment wants the personnel of the security service providers also included, just to make sure that the paragraph conveys the correct message. We note the comment and we will draft a proposal on that. Right to Know campaign said that these powers of access control officers and security managers might be abused, and I think we've heard some testimony of that, especially from COSATU, where it has in fact been abused and is being abused still. So we wanted to just point out, in clause 25.1a, it specifically said that the security manager may take lawful steps that are necessary. And that word lawful there denotes the fact that it cannot be this type of strip search or whatever. That will not be allowed. Also clause 27.1n, when the regulations on the access control measures will be made, those regulations will also create a regime where these powers may not be abused. It could possibly African Catholic Bishops Conference commented that clause 25 is too wide and allow for abuse, but I think the comments that I just, or the responses that I just referred to address that concern. Abkov had the concern that private security should not be doing these functions, but it should be done by the SAPS. Unfortunately, guarding duties is not part of the SAP's mandate, and it will literally require a massive expansion of SAP's personnel. The other issue that might also be at stake is when SAPs guard the premises of a privately owned company. That's a critical infrastructure. That just doesn't sound right. So that proposal is not supported by the drafting team. Abkov also said that the role of CIRA is clear, is unclear. We once again just refer to the definitions thereof, but the clause will be relooked to see if it's necessary to insert something about CIRA there. But of course, we cannot enforce the Private Security Industry Regulatory Act in this act. We cannot say you must comply with that act, because that act says it. We don't have to say it. Chair, the most contentious issue, of course, is the offences and penalties. There are many concerns about the severity of the penalties, disclosure of information, etc. I'm not going to go through all of them. But what I want to say is, when we drafted the legislation or this bill, we divided the offences into three groups. Serious offences that will form part of an investigation into terrorism and espionage, for instance, belong in the first group. The committee will know that sabotage was removed by the from SIU law by the Protection of Constitutional Democracy Against Terrorist and Related Activities Act. So there's no crime like sabotage anymore in the law. Unless there's an element of terrorist intent, in which case it will fall under the so-called Pokhtatara Act. So the comments and all the relevant submissions are noted. We will draft proposals in respect of these offences. Redrafting, say there's in recent weeks there was a judgment by the High Court here in the Western Cape, the case of Ngwana versus the state, where Section 12.1A of the Regulation of Gatherings Act was found to be unconstitutional. Although, as SAPs who are appealing that judgment, the judges obviously made very valuable remarks in terms of the criminalization of certain actions. And we will redraft most of these offences with a view to incorporate those issues that were mentioned in the submissions. One of the possibilities that must be considered is whether the minor offences could be subject to a lesser criminal penalty, whereas more severe offences that denote terrorism or sabotage be subjected to the penalties that are currently in the Act, and also to have those really minor offences, see if there is a way in which we can decriminalise those accidental selfies, etc. There are other comments also, inclusion of a harm test, which I think is not impossible, and also the public interest defence insertion that was greatly canvassed by some of the commentators. It is something that will be new in South African law, so it will require some looking at and research checklist. With regards to the regulations, there are only two comments, I think. The research unit commented whether 3 months would be sufficient time to allow for the regulations. Also mentioned that NEDLAC wanted these to come into operation simultaneously. The intention is, Chair, that the issues regarding the transitional period. The first question was, does SSA have the capacity to perform vetting? Chairperson, it's respectfully submitted that this is a function that they have to perform, and that the committee should not shape legislation to accommodate resource issues, with all due respect. Another issue was the time limit for the declaration, whether the 60-month period is too long or too short, and whether the declaration, the final declaration, will be dealt with within the 60-month period. The intention is certainly to deal with it within that 60-month period, but also to allow the National Commissioner sufficient time to go through the process and not just hurry through the process, and that we again have a situation that we have to somehow come back within that 60 months to report something that has happened directly. So we calculated the 60-month period on the basis of how many national key points there are and approximately how long it would take to do this physical security assessment. Then another question that came up is the vetting process SSA free of charge. I made some inquiries. It seems that it is indeed, if it's for a government function, it is indeed free of charge. Okay, so I wondered why I paid so much for my security clearance. just on a lighter note. Then the South African Catholic Bishops' Conference also made a valuable comment in the sense that they commented that the list of the deemed critical infrastructures must also be published, which I think is a fair comment. So we will note that for implementation. Chair, with regards to the costs, we did an initial costing in 2016. At the time, as I said earlier, the board members, it looked like around 900,000 rand for implementation. With regards to the spelling mistake, it should read SAPS and NKP. That is the current budget, or current budget at that time, for implementing the whole NKP and so-called strategic installations system. Inspectors, valuation, that would amount to nearly 8 million. So, but that is in the operational budget of SAPS at the moment. So that's not an additional amount that we need to be concerned about. I just need to... Yeah. Thank you, Chair. I think that's the end of it.
Thank you very much, Brigadier. Members, we will take a 15-minute lunch break. 15-minute lunch break outside. Everybody's welcome, and then we'll come back just to determine the way forward. Thank you. And that is for clarification. 15 minutes. Thank you.